From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Bill Murray on lounge singers, bad acting, and playing annoying but lovable characters. Also today, historian Simon Schama examines the slipperiness of the historical fact. It's the subject of his new historical novel, Dead Certainties. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg traces the evolution of the phrase politically correct. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Kurdish refugees marched in an anti-government demonstration that turned violent today in the northern Iraqi town of Zako. NPR's Deborah Wong has more.
Several hundred Kurds gathered today at a UN flag-raising ceremony at the giant tent city near Zako. They carried banners and chanted, "Bush yes, Saddam no, down with Saddam." The Kurds marched into town, and at one point they surrounded a man whom they accused of being an Iraqi spy. The Kurds beat the man with rocks and sticks. He was eventually rescued by two American military police. In town, the demonstrators reportedly overturned and set fire to four cars in front of the Iraqi police station. American military officials say there were no serious injuries. Elsewhere in northern Iraq, British commandos on patrol near the city of Sirsink were fired upon by Iraqi troops hiding in Saddam Hussein's summer palace. The Marines returned fire, according to British military officials. It was the first exchange of fire between British and Iraqi troops since the Allied operation began. I'm Deborah Wong reporting.
Authorities in Arizona say that seven people were killed today when their sightseeing plane crashed and burned near the Grand Canyon National Park. The crash apparently occurred early this afternoon. It was found by a Park Service helicopter that was investigating reports of a forest fire. The plane and about an acre of underbrush around the crash site were said to be engulfed in flames. The cause of the crash wasn't immediately known. Secretary of State James Baker and his Soviet counterpart, Alexander Besmertnik, have concluded 2 days of talks in Cairo. They closed their discussions with a conference with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Lori Neff has a report.
Secretary of State Baker says Israel and Syria remain divided on how to convene a Middle East peace conference. He says at issue is what role the United Nations might play and whether or not the conference should be a one-time affair.
Nobody can impose peace upon the parties. They have got to want it. And so they have got to find a way to come together on issues such as this.
The comments follow 2 days of talks with Soviet Foreign Minister Besmertnik. They come amid reports Baker frustrated at lack of progress is searching for new ways to initiate a peace conference. The foreign ministers say along with the peace efforts, their discussions included Kurdish refugees, regional and bilateral issues, including a possible superpower summit this summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
The Federal Reserve said today that production from the nation's factories was up slightly in April, enough to end a 6-month string of losses. Industrial production was up by 0.1%, helped mainly by a rise in the output of motor vehicles. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points today to close at 2,924.42. Advances edged declines in light trading of 129 million shares. This is NPR. Ethnic Serbians in the Yugoslav Republic of Croatia have voted overwhelmingly in favor of uniting their region with the Serbian Republic. Officials said that yesterday's vote drew 73% of the eligible voters in the Serbian part of South Croatia. 99% of those who voted said they favored joining the Serbian Republic and remaining part of the Yugoslav Federation. Croatian officials have charged that the vote was illegal. The Croatian government has called for a referendum on the republic's future within the next week. In the meantime, Yugoslavia's Federal Army has been given authority to keep the peace after 18 people were killed in clashes between Croatian police and Serbian nationalists. In Peru, rebels are holding 9 policemen hostage and are demanding that international human rights workers be allowed to investigate alleged abuses by government security forces. Mike DeMott reports from Lima.
The rebels belong belonged to the pro-Cuban Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. They took the police hostage during an attack Friday night in the town of Rioja in the northern department of San Martin, located some 400 miles north of Lima. The attack was part of a rebel offensive in four cities in San Martin. Since then, the defense ministry has declared a dusk-to-dawn curfew for the entire department. Ministry communique has branded the rebels as criminals and charged that they are in league with drug traffickers who operate in the region. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike DeMott in Lima.
South Africa's Anglican Archbishop appealed today for the country's leaders to avert what he called an outright civil war. Desmond Tutu called on the government to ban the carrying of dangerous weapons in inflammatory situations. Continued violence in the black townships has claimed about 850 lives this year. The government has banned many types of weapons, but declined to include certain traditional weapons, such as Zulu spears and axes. Tutu also appealed to the African National Congress not to carry out its threat to break off talks with the government. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Bill Murray. In the Washington Post, reporter Hal Hinson wrote about him. In the movies, Murray is a symbol of everything slothful and unhealthy. He slouches when he walks, mumbles when he talks. He's unscrupulous and cynical and downright strange, the poster child for wretched excess and insincerity. Bill Murray stars in the new film, What About Bob? He plays another overbearing character, a neurotic guy with lots of phobias. He finds a new psychiatrist, played by Richard Dreyfuss, but it's August, and the doctor is leaving town to vacation with his family. Murray feels he can't face his phobias alone, so he tracks down the family, and when he finds them, he just won't go away. This character is truly unbearable. I asked Bill Murray the trick to making a character like that lovable at the same time.
I have that problem in my life. That's generally the problem of getting away with whatever I'm doing. So I have practice in this area. I'm rehearsed and trained in this area. But you're right, this was a kind of hard job in that it did get annoying. I mean, and the part was maybe a little overwritten in the annoying area. So I had to change some things, make things less annoying always, and to eliminate some things.
What did you change?
Well, I changed a lot of things. I mean, that's my job, is to take what writers write and change it. I'm just saying that for any potential writers out there to avoid me in the future.
But you might be warned, yeah.
It's what, you know, it's sort of, the writing is just is often general because the physical reality is always different than what a writer can imagine, or it's often different than what a writer imagines. So something that seems sort of just the right amount of annoying on the printed page, depending upon how the previous scenes have been shot or demonstrated, you know, certain areas get washed out, you know. They get cleaned out, you know. And if you milk a certain kind of annoyance that is too close to the way the next scene is written annoyance-wise, you have to change it. So you're constantly trying to make it less annoying so it'll be palatable. Because you can always turn up the annoyance level. And you want to save it. You want to pick your shot for when the other person is, his performance is needs more annoyance. So,
are directors or screenwriters ever offended when you want to change the lines or improvise on the lines?
Well, not any of the ones that I've worked with yet. Generally, if you want to change the line and improve the line, they like it. I know that, like, some writers I worked with, I changed a lot of lines, and now they get paid a fortune to write scripts. So they're... They're really happy with the changes that I've made, and it makes them look good if it's good. It's when you change it completely in the essence of what the idea of what they wanted is changed that I think they get upset. But movies are a collaborative business, and I don't think there are only a handful of people that are expert at writing movies, and I don't consider myself one either. But having to play the stuff, I know that it always has to change and adjust because it's two languages. It's words and pictures.
Now, last year you co-directed Quick Change, which mm-hmm. you also starred in. Mm-hmm. Did you feel any different about improvisation when it was your movie? Did you want the actors to improvise, and did you improvise as much?
I don't think I improvised as much, but I think that's because I worked on the script a long time.
Right, so you didn't need to.
And I worked No, I didn't need to as much. But there was one actor in our film, Tony Shalhoub, who played a cab driver who pretty much came in, and his part was unwritten. It was just everything was suggested, all what he was supposed to do, but there were no words because he invented this language, this sort of Middle European Eastern language, Middle Eastern language, to speak as this cab driver whom we can't understand and can't understand us. And so everything he did was a surprise, you know. So and he kills in the movie. He's really funny. I think it's one of the funniest performances I've seen in a long time. And there were several parts where what a director wants is somebody who will take what's on the page and bring more to it, you know. You can get a number of people who will come and do it exactly as it's written, but you want somebody who's going to bring more. That's when you really feel like, oh, what a good day it was today. This guy came in and just killed it and made it better than it was written.
My guest is Bill Murray, and he's starring in the new movie, What About Bob? Now, you've really made it in the entertainment industry, but you've also really perfected that kind of showbiz phony sincerity, which is kind of epitomized by the lounge singer that you used to do. I'd really love to hear when that kind of showbizy stuff started to really make an impression on you.
Well, when I really got deep into it, I mean, I think it probably was the Jerry Lewis telethon business that started. You start watching that telethon. I mean, it's not as great now as it was in the old days when Jerry was on, like, various maintenance programs, and he would have mood swings in the course of the show. It's we used to have a club called the Sammy Club in New York, this friend of ours, Bob Tischler, and we would, several of us would go to his house to watch the Sammy and Company show. That's, like, the clearest example.
And what would you do when you watched it?
Well, first of all, he had a poster of Sammy that he would unroll and put on the wall. And then we'd just go crazy watching it, absolutely crazy. And sometimes if someone weren't with us, the phone would ring during the commercial, and it would be someone who was, you know, sort of an honorary member of the club who wasn't there, who was, you know, out of town or something. And it would just be hysterical laughter of what had just happened during the last sequence. And then, of course, you'd hang up for the commercial. And the same thing would happen watching the Jerry Lewis telethon. I mean, you could actually, 5:30 in the morning, you could call someone, you know, and he'd pick up the phone and say, "I saw it," you know, because there were people who were monitoring the entire telethon, watching the stuff that Jerry was doing in the middle of the night.
Now, how old were you when you started, you know, obsessing on Jerry Lewis telethons and joining the Sammy Club?
Well, that was late. I mean, I don't want you to put me in any kind of a weird showbiz kid thing. That was later. I was an adult. I could vote and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't childhood.
Now, what was the TV that made the biggest impression on you when you were growing up? Did you watch a lot of it?
I guess I did. I mean, I watched it all. You know, people say, well, what were your influences? I could not identify an influence other than my family, you know. My brother Brian was probably my biggest influence, you know.
In what respect?
Well, I watched him on the stage a lot, and at the Second City in Chicago. And,
right.
You know, I just saw, that was really my training. I didn't get much training from television. My father and my brother and my grandfather. My father was a very tough laugh, and then my brother was in a difficult guy to make laugh, and it had to be funny, it had to be good. And my brother was on the stage and with Harold Ramis and John Belushi and Joe Flaherty, and these guys were the funniest guys in America at that time, I thought. And I just watched them work, you know, almost every night on the stage and saw how they understood the rhythm of a live audience.
Yeah, well, your brother Brian Doyle Murray is, I think, 5 years older than you. Were you ever considered the hanger-on? Was he ever annoyed when you'd show up all the time?
No, I think he was a really good brother to me, you know. I mean, he was almost a father after my father died, so he was, you know, he was very good to me, and, you know, I owe him, I think I owe him $200, but I mean, I think I owe him a lot and a lot of credit for whatever success I've had.
Did you start performing when he was doing Second City? Did you hang around long enough and make yourself known in such a way that you were invited to perform yourself?
Well, that's eventually what happened, yeah. And he came back. He'd gone out to California for a while to work, and he came back, and at one time we were in the same show together, which was kind of fun.
Now, at this point, when you were doing Second City, were you already into the kind of unctuous side of show business?
No, I wasn't good enough. I was still trying to perform the scenes that I was supposed to do well on the stage. That sort of thing just was starting. I mean, Joe Flaherty was a guy who was really big on that sort of stuff. And just cheap acting was a thing that we did a lot, you know.
Oh,
cheap, yeah. We were more interested in cheap acting. There was a great movie called South Sea Sinner with McDonald Carey and Frank Lovejoy that was like the cheapest thing you ever saw in your life. And you know, the big plot thing was the guy was accused of selling crude rubber to the Japanese. You know, I mean, it was just the nuttiest, goofy movie. And the cutaways of this tiny model boat tossing at sea and having to perform surgery at sea with just a bottle of whiskey and a knockout punch and stuff like that. Really cheap stuff. And that was about as close we got to bad show business at that time.
In talking about bad movies and bad acting, was that already under your skin, or did you have to learn how to do that really bad reaction shot, you know?
Well, once it's been identified, then it's immediate. It's like once you spot a cancer cell, then it's very clear what they look like. And that sort of was the same thing. There wasn't much to learning with it, learning it. Once you see it and you identify it, then it was as easy. I mean, I could do bad acting for the rest of my life, only bad acting. As it is now, I just try to avoid it. But I could just do only it, and many, many kinds of bad acting. I feel like once you get in, it's like a cult, you know. They give you all the secrets as soon as you walk in the door.
Does it ever get in the way of a real performance? You know, do you ever have to suppress the really bad acting moves and let genuine, you know, more subtle acting take over?
Well, that's a funny question because, like in this movie, what about Bob? I play a guy who's annoying, you know, so at any time I can be doing, you know, Dick Van Patten or any kind of, like, I can be doing anybody that's annoyed me or you know, I can be doing anybody. I think, oh, God, there's a way to say this that's really annoying, and I look at it and I go, who was that, you know? Because it's somebody who has annoyed me or has been annoying in a certain thing. Whining. Sometimes you do that whining thing. There's a lot of whining, but you've got to always step back from it. It is a bit of a problem. You do a scene and you go cut and you go, sorry, too much, you know? It was just, and it would be literally, you know, fill in the blank of someone you really hate, and it would be someone you could identify practically.
Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? Now, in the movie Tootsie, I think you improvised a lot of this role, but you played a very self-involved, kind of experimental playwright. Did you know a lot of people like that in theater?
Self-involved?
Yeah, what could I possibly be thinking of?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I always... Guys whose art was so precious that it couldn't be explained to people, you know, really, and asking a question was like, oh, man, if you don't get it, you know, that kind of thing. It was always, I always enjoyed that, you know. I enjoyed meeting, like, people like that because it gave me an opportunity to unleash, you know, the darker side of my own wit upon them, you know. And you just wait, and you could sit with them for an hour and a half, and then finally there'd be that opening, and then you could just put a dagger right through their gut, you know. Because anyone that, you know, that attitude was just, it just invited trouble. But some of the things I said is that self-involved guy, I really do believe, you know. So it wasn't just totally, I was just being a drunk and obnoxious guy, but some of the things were really true, just like these guys that I would meet, you know, had some things to say.
Well, what's something that you said in Tootsie that you really believed in, but was also kind of funny and ironic at the same time?
I wanted to have a theater that was only open when it rained.
You genuinely did?
Yeah. Well, I said that in the movie.
Oh.
I said I wanted to
have
a theater that's only open when it rains. And I believe that from my own experience in the theater, that the best audience you could ever have even was not a full house, but a house that was three quarters full because of a very bad, or half full because of a very bad storm, which had kept people away, and they hadn't bothered to come, and they would come in still shaking the water off their shoulders and their heads and their hats, and they'd still be wet. Their hair would be wet on the back of their neck. Because it grounded them in a reality. It made them it put them on the planet. They weren't dreaming, they were really on the planet. So they were ready. the ideal specimens. They lived here, you know.
If you're just joining us, Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Bill Murray is my guest, and he's starring in a new movie called What About Bob? You actually started performing when you were in high school, right?
Well, everybody did, didn't they? I mean, no. I performed in high school just to get out of class. You know, that was the thing. You auditioned for a show, and you would get certain hours off in the afternoon and not have to do homework and, you know, be excused from certain things. Actually, at my school, it was a boys' school. There were girls in these shows, so you could get out, and you even got to rehearse at night, which was really insane.
So musicals? What did you get to be in?
Well, that was The Music Man was the big one, because it was great because we had to rehearse for months to learn all these dance numbers and vocal numbers, and to work with girl dancers from Sacred Heart, you know, the high school girls. And these were like rich girls from downtown who drank, you know, like gin out of 7-Up bottles and stuff. So that was the best job I ever had, I think.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you were a dancer in The Music Man?
Yes, I was a dancer.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine you dancing in the chorus of a high school musical.
They wanted somebody who was big enough to lift up this one girl dancer, and they couldn't. The other people that auditioned, I walked by, and the auditions were going on, and there were a couple of very pretty girls in there, so I just walked in there, and they said you know, and I literally just did just to see what was going on, and I was like the biggest guy by about 5 inches, so they said you're going to pick up the big girl, you know. And she was big. You know, I had to pick her up on my shoulder. She was large. It was just typecasting. It could have been Lou Ferrigno got the job. You know, he would have, yeah. Lou Ferrigno, you're a dancer? Yes, I am, you know, at once. I mean, it was really all about getting somebody up on your shoulders. But I don't regret it. Yes, I was a dancer, Terry, yes. And I still go out and dance every once in a while, although I don't do it on the Broadway stage.
Oh, I just know high school musicals had just the corniest choreography.
Well, actually, ours was just the rote one that came with the Music Man book. It wasn't bad. It was pretty good. So we were sort of doing pretty much the Shapoopy number from the musical.
Let me ask you a couple of things about Saturday Night Live. You joined after Chevy Chase left. Had you auditioned for the first round of the show?
Mm-hmm.
Your brother got in as a writer and you didn't. Was that very upsetting?
Well, he didn't really get in at that time as a writer.
Oh, he didn't?
But,
I'm sorry.
Was it upsetting not to get that job? Well,
yeah.
I didn't know what it was. We were all auditioning. Everybody was auditioning for this job. We were in this National Lampoon show, and, you know, Lorne Michaels and Tom Schiller came around and looked at the show. They saw the show 3 times. And we were all sort of in the, you know, whatever, the finals, the semifinals or something. And I knew they were going to pick some people, and they like every once in a while you'd hear, oh, they picked so-and-so, you know, somebody. And then we were offered another job. My brother and Chris Guest, who I was working with on the Lampoon show, the radio show, and myself were offered another job on this show called Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell. And they were... you know, they hadn't picked anybody in the other show, and I didn't really know what was going to happen with that show, and I knew the odds of all of us getting that show were, you know, I don't know. So I guess we just sort of decided to take the other job. They just hadn't made up their minds, and so we just decided to take the other job. And I'm glad I did. I had a good time on the Cosell show. Was like a wonderful combination of nightmare and hysteria and hysterical stories. I have much better stories from the Cosell show than I have from Saturday Night Live.
Yes, well, tell one.
No. No, those are, you got to pay money and you have to buy me drinks to get those stories out. They're really, well, I don't know. There is the story about Shamu.
The killer whale?
Yes. We were supposed to go live to Shamu in San Diego. The producer of the show, the Cosell show, was Rue Narlage, and his thing was satellite switching in those days. And we were supposed to go to Shamu at one point later in the show, and Shamu was going to be ridden by Diana Nyad, the first woman to swim around Manhattan Island. This is kind of how the show got packaged. But opening in the show, we had LaBelle, who was red hot at the moment with Lady Marmalade and their big songs. So they were promised 2 shows and 2 songs, but just before air, they were told by Rue Narlage they were only going to get 1 song. And when they told them they were cutting the second song, they just said, mm-mm. And it was a great moment at the stage door where they said, LaBelle, 20 seconds, and just these three heads shaking their head, no way. And they just turned and walked to the street and got in their limousine and pulled away. So you could hear from, 200 feet away, you could hear everyone going, go to Shamu, you know, kind of thing. So we got to go early out to Shamu in San Diego. You know, you're not even buying me a drink, and I'm telling you a great show business story. We got to go early to Shamu in San Diego, and there's Soupy Sales, who is like our host for the Shamu sequence, out there, and he's got a, you see him with the earpiece in his ear, and you see the words register on his face where they say, Soupy, you've got to fill 5 minutes. And the look of, like, terror and elation on his face. And Soupy starts, like, splashing water in his face. It was absolutely, he literally went so far as, I think, to pour a bucket of water on his head just to get last, hey, what about this? Hey, filling 5 minutes of time. Unfortunately, we have to see the rest of Shamu's act, which at that time was the bicentennial year, had three guys dressed as the fife player, the drummer, and the guy with the flag riding on Shamu, standing on Shamu, as he goes around the pool at around 30 miles an hour. But then we've got to go back later in the show for Diana Nyad being the first woman to ride a killer whale. Well, we've already seen, like, the bicentennial poster standing on this whale, doing about 30 in full costume with the tri-cornered hats on. And when they gently lowered Diana Nyad onto the killer whale, you know, with the harnesses and this whole baloney and handlers, and I think they even had guys with guns or something, you know, in case the whale went berserk. You know, it was like a great melodrama thing, which had all been killed by having to go to Shamu early, and the whale just sort of slowly pulled around the tank, very, very slowly, about 2 miles an hour, and Howard was going, Diana Nyad! Riding the killer whale, the bravery of the woman. You know, riding and swimming in the Hudson River and the East River, you know, wasn't brave, but riding this whale at 1 mile an hour was.
This must have been the closest you got to really being in the kind of
bad show business. Yeah. It was really wonderful.
I guess it's a kind of like initiation, right? Everybody should go through who's in it, right? To be in like the real thing.
Well, it was a lot more fun than I imagined. I mean, Saturday Night Live was a lot of fun, and we used to go home and see the air show because we'd be done. And we'd go home and see their show after that. But, you know, we had the advantage of being done, you know, and we could watch their show. And we'd have these great stories, far better than any stories they have from Saturday Night Live.
You must get offered a lot of roles now. How do you decide what you're going to take and what you're not going to, and what you think is just going to be duplicating what you've done and what will be fun to do?
I wish I had a good answer to that one, Terry. Like, I throw them up the steps and whichever one goes the highest. I heard someone use that one once. I didn't think it was funny, but I think the... I don't know. You just read them. There's so many of them that are the same. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. I mean, you go to the movies very much. I mean, there aren't very many of them that you like to watch. So you can imagine how many of them you'd like to be in for 3 months at a time.
Well, Bill Murray, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been interesting, and I gave you that great story. So I guess you owe me a drink.
Right. Hey, next time we see each other.
Okay.
Yeah. My guest has been Bill Murray, and he stars in the new movie, What About Bob? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Historian Simon Schama is best known for his recent book, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. Coming up, we talk about his new book, a historical novel that's about how events of the past are distorted by historians. The concept of political correctness has caught on so well, even the president has addressed it. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg traces the evolution of the phrase. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House has announced that the U.S. is prepared to destroy its chemical stockpile if an international agreement is reached. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The announcement comes on the eve of the resumption of the conference on disarmament in Geneva, and it reverses two key U.S. positions. The U.S. had previously reserved the right to retaliate in kind against a chemical attack. The administration had also followed what is called a 2% solution, meaning it promised to destroy all but 2% or 500 tons of its chemical stockpile. The change in policy is designed to inject new energy into the international talks to ban chemical weapons. The U.S. is also calling for the setting of a target date to conclude the talks that would ban the production, acquisition, storage, and use of chemical weapons. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Also in Washington, a sharply divided U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that an individual arrested without a warrant may be held in jail for up to 48 hours without a hearing. This decision stems from a case in Riverside, California, which challenged that court's practices. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Riverside had a policy of holding persons arrested without a warrant for up to 7 days without a hearing. Not good enough, the court said. As a general rule, no individual should be held for more than 48 hours without a hearing. Writing for the five-member court majority, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said the Constitution's ban on unreasonable seizure of a person is not violated by postponing a hearing for up to 48 hours in order to accommodate the overly burdened criminal justice system. But Justice Antonin Scalia broke with his fellow conservatives and joined the court's three more liberal members in dissent. A person who is arrested without a court-approved warrant, said Scalia, is entitled to a hearing as soon as he's booked and certainly in no more than 24 hours. Hereafter, said Scalia, a law-abiding citizen wrongfully arrested may be compelled to await the grace of a Dickensian bureaucratic machine as it churns its cycle for up to 2 days, never once given the opportunity to show a judge that there is absolutely no reason to hold him, that a mistake has been made. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Washington has assured the Soviet Union that it will pull its military forces out of northern Iraq as soon as international aid groups take over the job of aid to thousands of refugees. Secretary of State James Baker met with the Soviet foreign minister in Cairo and said that it was very important that the UN as well as international relief agencies take over the responsibility of helping the Kurdish refugees. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 4 points to close at 2,924.42 on volume of 129 million shares. Trading today was very light. This is NPR News. In South Africa, Winnie Mandela has been found guilty on 4 charges of kidnapping. A Supreme Court judge also found the wife of African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela guilty of being an accessory to assault in the beating of 4 young men at her home. Mrs. Mandela had been charged with kidnapping and assault. 2 co-defendants were found guilty of kidnapping. The 3 had been charged in the abduction and beating of 4 young men from a church home, and 1 of the 4 was killed. In Chicago today, an out-of-court settlement headed off a product liability trial involving the makers of Tylenol and the families of 7 people who died after taking tainted capsules 9 years ago. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Chicago.
Jury selection was to begin today in the trial of the McNeil Consumer Products subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson. The company was charged with negligence by the survivors of 7 people who died after taking extra-strength Tylenol capsules laced with cyanide. Both sides declined to discuss the amount of the settlement, but apparently it was enough to dissuade the families from going public during a closely watched trial, said their attorney Leonard Ring.
They wanted to end it. They didn't want to come here to testify if they didn't have to.
The manufacturer had also wanted to avoid publicity about its connection to a crime that shocked the nation in the fall of 1982. No one has ever been charged with the actual tampering. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Officials in Germany say that retail sales in the western part of the country climbed by a seasonally adjusted 11% in the first quarter compared with the same time last year. This study did not include retail figures for eastern Germany. Sales in western Germany have gone up steadily since economic and currency union between East and West Germany went into effect last summer. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Simon Schama, is the author of a history of the French Revolution called Citizens. It was called a revisionist history, both in praise and criticism. Schama is acutely aware that historians can never be certain they are accurately reconstructing the past. That gap between events as they occurred and as they are later retold by historians is the subject of his new novel, Dead Certainties. There are interlocking historical stories, each told from several conflicting perspectives. One story is about James Wolfe, the British general who defeated the French in Quebec in 1759. I wanted to know what interested Schama in telling the general's story and in using that story as the point of departure to discuss larger questions about how history is written.
The major thing for me there was the issue of historical invention. I remembered as a kid, it seems incredibly embarrassing now, but when I was a child, the year of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, we all read books with titles like Our Empire Story, in which impossibly white people did amazingly heroic things against unspeakable odds. Wolfe was one of them. And one went with those books in one's hand into a place like Westminster Abbey and looked at Wolfe's tomb, and one was exposed to a kind of historical inevitability. The empire had to be this way. The hero had to die in a position of enormous sacrifice, almost a martyrdom. And I was giving a course, actually, at Harvard on the British Empire, and someone said to me, you know, there are some of Wolfe's letters in the library, and I went to look at them. And the first thing I noticed was, instead of a powerfully self-motivated heroic script, these little kind of spidery, frail, tortured hand, and what the hero spoke about was not the destiny of the British Empire, but headaches, the way his bowels performed. He was a mess. And really, that story is about the process of invention, of myth, and fiction making to the point where it congeals into an inevitable chronicle of power.
Well, you know, two of the ways you tell the story of Wolfe's death. One way is through the eyes of a soldier who is in the middle of a miserable battle, and he sees Wes dying with kind of ooze dripping from
Wolfe
him.
Wolfe dying.
And it's a kind of like lonely, ugly murder. But then you look at the Benjamin West painting from 1770,
That's right.
11 years after the general's death. And this is, why don't you describe the painting?
Well, the painting really is an icon. It's it's exactly organized like a deposition of Christ. We have the body of the general clothed in his correct contemporary uniform of the 1750s, something which created a great scandal since he wasn't Christ, nor was he a Roman hero. But his kind of body is sort of being gently folded to the ground, and he's attended by an enormous crowd of onlookers, just as the deposition of the cross was. They are mourning. One figure is actually has his hands in a position of prayer, and as a silent figure of a noble Indian seen in profile, done very idealistically, who is a kind of mute witness to this crucial historical moment. Now, West was a young American making his way inside difficult, rather crusty, snobbish British society, who decides to produce this extraordinary spectacle. It was a production number in exactly that sense. And it comes off. Everybody faints away with rapture, and they think about the historical event as West paints it. He has really painted the event into history, and there it really remains for 200 years. And you're right, what I was trying to do in this way, a bit like, you know, the Japanese film Rashomon, is give alternative voices, alternative witnesses, including ordinary soldier, kind of stumbles onto the event, and whose voice is the opposite, who's very laconic, whereas West's voice, done into paint, is a huge, great piece of rhetoric.
Will you quote the painter Benjamin West in describing why he wanted this heroic depiction of the general's death? And he says, Wolfe must not die like a common soldier under a bush. To move the mind, there should be a spectacle presented to raise and warm the mind, and all should be proportioned to the highest idea conceived of the hero. A mere matter of fact will never produce the effect. Do you think that this is typical of the distortion that happens when art tries to represent history? Or is it just typical of a certain kind of art?
Well, it is typical of a certain kind of art, but one which has had tremendous power. If you look at the history of art, the history of classicism is intended to represent edifying moments. And what was shocking, or what was really brilliantly inventive about West's death of Wolfe, was that instead of having somebody from remote antiquity in this position of exemplary sacrifice, it was someone really quite recent. It was just a recent event and done in modern dress, and it triggered off a huge controversy. There is a sort of general issue, I suppose, not just in painting, Terry, but in sort of history writing, that historians, I think, inevitably, and for very obvious reasons, tend to focus in on events to which they assign huge significance, so that very often they too, while not being quite so scandalously idealizing as the young American Benjamin West, tend to foreground heroes and perhaps villains. If you think of Bob Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson, something I admire a lot, something people said, I think, quite correctly about the last volume, was the villain and the hero were very starkly represented, almost as though they were part of a Greek drama. So I suppose while I don't want to condescend to that view at all, but I did want to sort of try and perform out a messier, more complicated, more banal, more cacophonous version, really, of the historical process.
Are there places during your life as a historian where you felt guilty of over-embroidering historical narrative to bring out a more heroic, symbolic quality in the story?
Well, I think, one's possibly going to say the book on the French Revolution, but the French Revolution, all the actors in that are so correctly self-conscious that they're living at a time of kind of terrifying drama, which their own private lives are at risk. It's very difficult to exaggerate, the intense and tragic quality of that event. I did write a book in my callow youth many, many years ago, which embarrassingly enough, I think is going to be reprinted in paperback next year. The first book I ever wrote was about actually the collapse of Holland at the time of the French Revolution. There, I think probably I did assign tremendously kind of poetic qualities to this experience, where people were really simply struggling for a crust of bread and trying to literally, in some cases, absolutely literally prevent the dikes from bursting over them. So I think maybe the younger you are, actually, the more tempted you are by poetic exaggeration and melodrama.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Simon Schama. He's a professor of history at Harvard, and his best-known book is Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. Now, his new book is a historical novel called Dead Certainties. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Historian Simon Schama is my guest. I want to get back to the Benjamin West painting.
Yes.
Of General Wolfe. In the way it heroicized Wolfe and Wolfe's death, and in the way it distorted the truth to make it seem more heroic, would you make a comparison to, say, contemporary miniseries? I'm not saying that artistically mm-hmm. they're on the same level, but we're all the time exposed now to historical novels and historical mm-hmm. miniseries that always take certain liberties with the fact just to make it a little more dramatic. Mm. But does that kind of stuff bug you a lot?
Well, I guess, you know, I'm not against historical miniseries on principle, but I'm always, this is going to get me in a lot of trouble, because they said, oh, yes, limey, do it better. You know, I always think they could be done so much better. I, in common with, my, what was it, 13 million others, was sort of bowled over by, you know, Ken and Rick Burns' incredible series on the Civil War, which seemed to me to, you know, foreground heroes and tragic figures. But because it really slowed down, it took time, and it had a wonderful kind of tempo, which came from reading letters and all those very extraordinary view of photographs. That did the job perfectly. It presented the memory of an event with all the kind of, you know, tragic power of which it was capable. It's when, in fact, miniseries are in a tremendous hurry to get Gregory Peck on the screen as Lincoln, you know, and do the Gettysburg Address and drown it in really slightly ghastly sort of Andrew Lloyd Webber thereabouts music, that it just really, this is sort of Hollywood putting on clothes. There was a lamentable miniseries on Napoleon, you know, where it seemed to me most time had been spent on judging the depth of Jackie Bissett's neckline, you know, as Josephine. You could see the rumpling of the hair, and the stories are so exciting and so dramatic and so extraordinary that I'm sort of always wanting them to be done much better.
Since your book is in part about what you describe as the slipperiness of historical fact, I'm wondering about the difference between how you were taught the American Revolution growing up in England and how you could
we
see
we tried to forget about the entire unfortunate event.
Because now you're a history professor, usually based in the United States at Harvard.
You know, I tell you the book I remember as a kid, which did slide over that with great genius, a book that I think none of my colleagues will own up ever to having read. That's Winston Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples. There, George III is presented more or less correctly as an impossible fathead. And there were certain heroes who, with gloomy expressions, saw it coming, like William Pitt the Elder, and the House of Commons, dominated by the King and other fatheads, goes tottering to predictable defeat. But of course, Winston Churchill's mum was an American. He adored America, and he sort of thought of himself partly as a kind of Atlantic figure. So somehow for him, it came out all right in the end. Nonetheless, even with this relatively jolly view of the transatlantic partnership, I couldn't help feeling that at the very least the great British Empire had stubbed its toe very painfully. So one was taught to sort of, you know, hurry up over this and get on with the Battle of Waterloo, and everything came out all right all over again. Then there was the 19th century and Napoleon's nose rubbed in the mud of Belgium. That was okay.
So how were you taught the revolution in school?
Well, we were taught it was that it was actually an avoidable mistake, I think. It was interesting. We would, you know, we didn't read the first lines of the Declaration of Independence. You know, the crucial word, first word of that is when. I mean, there's when in the course of assumes that at a certain point a society becomes so mature that it cannot simply be bullied, patronized, and made to pay taxes it can't see any reason to pay for. We were taught that, no, it was a kind of family quarrel. It was a sort of house divided, that it could have been patched up, that even as we speak, New York City could be like Toronto, peopled with loyal Scots and part of the great family of the Commonwealth. It's absolutely ridiculous, really. We certainly weren't taught about it as a bloody, difficult war, which was brilliantly exploited by the French, and which in some sense was an inevitable separation. But remember, I was taught that in the aftermath of the last war, when British children like me were absolutely conscious that the war might have turned out very differently hadn't it not been for Franklin Roosevelt.
You're a history professor at Harvard. Mm-hmm. What makes you uncomfortable about academia? What don't you like about it?
Well, the immense sort of, I mean, the sense in which the, you know, the word which does really send my spirit sinking to my boots is the phrase, the historical profession. One goes to huge conventions and conferences where thousands of historians just talk to other thousands of historians. And they do so not just out of a sense of ritual, but the sort of sense that really a profession, you know, it's rather like engineering or the law or something, should develop its own private forms of language. And it is really a kind of mystique will separate you from the general reader. I mean, obviously, those historians with whom I feel closest kinship are historians very often who've written before there was such a thing as the historical profession. I mean, I'm not presuming to compare myself with, you know, Macaulay or Parkman or such like. But, you know, sort of men and women of letters, really, sort of people for whom the storytelling aspect, for whom the memory aspect was really the central reason. They wanted to be a witness to a group of readers about their culture's past. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sound too snotty about this at all. There are all sorts of historians from within academia. I think of Jonathan Spence, who writes in Yale about China, Jim McPherson, who writes brilliantly about the Civil War at Princeton. But by and large, you have to really be quite determined to do that. You know, I have small children, and I do go around schools a bit, trying just simply to be a kind of historical storyteller at the classroom. And I do wish professors talked more to schools. I think the more they talk to schools, the more upset they would be about the kind of textbooks that's being actually fed to their children. Because they seem to me textbooks written by committees for political, you know, adoption purposes, and texts which are almost designed to have the blood and the kind of excitement drained out of them.
So what keeps you in academia? You've given us your critique.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky at Harvard because I do get to sort of teach students in art history. We have a kind of the famously self-designating core curriculum. So I teach students, not just people who are majoring in history. I do have wonderful colleagues in other disciplines as well as my own. It's an incredible sort of, there's not a day I don't sort of congratulate myself on my undeserved good fortune for being paid to tell stories, you know, for me to sort of stand up as a kind of historical ham actor and sort of, you know, kind of go on about some remote event.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Simon Sharma's new novel is Dead Certainties. This is Fresh Air. Time to check in and see what's happening on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Bush has said he wants an international accord to do away with chemical weapons in the world, and he says the United States would forswear the use of those weapons for any reason. Winnie Mandela in South Africa is found guilty of kidnapping four young men and being an accessory to their beating. There's been no sentencing as yet. Also, Danny Zwerling has a report on AIDS in the Ivory Coast. And we'll talk with Louise Erdrich and Michael Doris. They're the authors of The Crown of Columbus. It's a novel about two Dartmouth professors who go off to the Caribbean in search of treasure left behind from the first voyage of Columbus.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In President Bush's recent commencement address at the University of Michigan, he joined the fray over the political correctness issue on the nation's campuses. The president warned against what he called attempts to micromanage casual conversation, which have invited people to look for an insult in every word, gesture, action. And, he said, crusades that demand correct behavior crush diversity in the name of diversity. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has been listening to the debate and wants to know why the word correct get such bad press.
The phrase politically correct began its life as a bit of routine Marxist jargon. I suspect it was a direct translation of the German phrase politisch korrekt, but that may itself have been a translation of a Chinese phrase from Chairman Mao. In any event, the German translation is a happy accident for the cultural right. In German, the word correct means simply right or true, as it does in an English sentence like, do you have the correct time? But it has another meaning in English when it's applied to social behavior. It suggests a conformity to superficial rules. You might ask which fork is correct to use with a fish course, or whether it's correct to use like as a conjunction. But you wouldn't ask what was the correct way to tell your sexual partner that you're HIV positive. So when the phrase politically correct was translated into English, it implied that the doctrines at stake were mere matters of fashion. Rhetorically, the phrase does the same work that radical chic did a generation ago. It drapes the cultural left in jeans and tie-dye T-shirts. Yet correct used to have a deeper moral sense. Dickens could speak about the importance of correct feeling, the emotions that were proper to a situation. And when Carl Schurz described President Lincoln in 1864 as a man of correct principles, he meant it as high praise. As it happens, correct is just one of a family of words that have undergone the same kind of trivialization. Take the word civility. When Thomas de Quincey described the English universities in 1858 as the recurring centers of civility, he didn't mean simply that the dons and students were courteous to one another. He meant that they preserved and refined the forms of conduct that are the basis of civilized society. And the word polite used to mean refined or cultivated, a sense that survives only in fossilized phrases like polite society and polite literature. But probably the word manners has suffered the most humiliating decline of all. Once it referred to general standards of moral conduct. That's what Tennyson had in mind when he wrote, "Manners are not idle, but the fruit of loyal nature and of noble mind." But people no longer see good manners as the fruit of a noble anything. Nor is it a topic for poets and philosophers. The great 18th century works on manners were written by Lord Chesterfield and Voltaire. The great work of the late 20th century was written by an advice columnist who refers to herself in the third person and camps herself up in high-collar dresses, lest anyone should think she takes the subject too seriously. The word manners is like a Shakespearean actor who ends his career playing a butler on a TV sitcom. It might have been kinder to kill it off a century ago. The writers of the Enlightenment made correctness and good manners one of the pillars of civil society. The other was liberal education. Both of them were intended to humanize the whole of society. Of course, by the Victorian period, the codes of social correctness had grown to a Talmudic complexity. In fact, I suppose you could describe them the way President Bush described modern standards of political correctness. They were attempts to micromanage conversation. And they led inevitably to the 20th century reaction, where outward forms were seen as trammels on the inner person. In the natural course of things, Emily Post set the stage for Mario Savio and Abby Hoffman. Still, Samuel Johnson or Matthew Arnold might be disconcerted to hear people who style themselves conservatives pronouncing the word correctness with a sneer. And they might not have understood why the universities should not be centers of both civility and civil liberties. The words are related, after all. But then that's the trouble with modern conservatism. It's lost its grasp of etymology.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In his new book, The Commanders, Bob Woodward reveals that General Colin Powell had reservations about going to war against Iraq and supported continuing the economic sanctions. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Bob Woodward about the relationship between top Pentagon leaders and the Bush administration. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.